Nick Malikov cycles the airlock shut, locks it, and engages pressure. Fishing around in his pants, he retrieves a battered packet of Tyrannosaurus Rex, trademark, cigarettes, flips one into his mouth, and lighting his smoke with a small slab of burnished steel, he leans against the wall. Eyes closed, breathing grey. Fuck me, that's better. Minutes pass. The only sound, the thrum of the engines. A computerized voice finally crackles through the airlock PA, ruining Malikov's carcinogenic bliss. Warning. Contaminant detected. Airlock 1. Malikov's eyes flutter open and he squints at the comms unit.
That you, Aiden?
No, Nicholas?
The one and only.
The kid inhales, frowns in the smoke. Actually, maybe not, now I think about it. Apologies, I cannot see you. I am not fully integrated with AVIS systems yet.
Heard they plugged you in, the kid smirks.
From a UTA battle carrier to this junker. The Verse sure has got a strange sense of humour, huh? I am failing to see the comedic value in the situation.
Makes two of us, I guess.
Warning. Contaminant level in airlock 1 rising.
Relax, Nick sighs. It's my Rex.
Warning. Fire detected. Airlock 1. Madonna, I'm just having a f***ing smoke, Aiden.
Sprinkler system engaging in 20 seconds.
Don't you dare.
15 seconds.
Searching in another of his cargo pockets, Malikov hauls out the silverback pistol he took from Juggler's corpse in the bathroom stall of Heimdall's station a week and a lifetime ago, and brandishing it at the nearest video camera, he growls around his SIG.
I don't know if you can see this, Sparky, but I'm currently swinging a pistol the size of a small anti-aircraft gun. You engage those sprinklers, I'ma shove this up whatever passes for your tailpipe. Feel me?
Firearm detected. Airlock 1. Threat level, red.
Damn right. Now let me finish my
reciprocity protocol engaged. Purging, airlock, O2 in 20 seconds.
Malikov blanches at that.
Hey, wait a minute.
15 seconds.
The kid glances out at the hangar bay, back into the mow. He stows the pistol in his pants, tugs on the hatch handle. No joy.
Aiden, I was just f***ing around.
10 seconds.
Aiden, open the door.
5 seconds. Warning alarms begin grinding, the lightning inside the airlock shifting to a deep blood red. Malikov is still tugging at the door, face scarlet with exertion.
Let me out!
O2 purge commencing.
God damn it, let me out!
The alarms rise to a crescendo, red globes flashing, a soft and deadly hiss seeping from the vents in the ceiling and floor. Malikov draws his pistol again, takes aim at glass that's almost certainly bulletproof, thumbs the safety off anyway, and just as suddenly as the alarms began, they die. The bloody light shifts back to off-white, the hissing stops, and Malikov is left standing there, eyes wide, forgotten smoke dangling from the corner of a dry-as-dust mouth.
Humour.
Malikov is still holding the pistol, unblinking.
What?
He whispers. An absurd, comedic, or incongruous quality causing amusement. The kid lowers his pistol slowly, face pale, cigarette bobbing as he hisses.
Are you f***ing kidding me?
I believe I just explained that, yes.
That was your idea of a joke?
You are not amused?
Madonna,
Malikov slithers down the wall, dropping the pistol at his feet. He runs one shaking hand through his hair, and for a second you can see it, the stress of the past week piling up inside. The fall of Heimdall, the murder of his family members, an alternate universe version of his cousin and Hannah dying in his arms. No swagger now. No wisecracks. dragging on his cigarette like his life depends on it, hands painted red, no matter how hard he scrubs them.
You okay, chum?
Malakoff hasn't even heard the EnviroSystem cycle, hasn't registered the door opening. He looks up into a pair of brown eyes and a concerned frown, a military-issue haircut and the uniform of a UTA Cyclone pilot, filled out about as perfect as a femme could ask for. Not that anyone's asking my opinion, of course. Second Lieutenant Ezra Mason glances at the pistol at Malakoff's feet, licks his lips and kneels down slow, like he's afraid to spook the other boy. He's taller than Malakoff, heavier set. There's something gentler in his eyes, though. They're the same age, but Malakoff grew up in the coils of one of the Versa's most notorious criminal organizations. Mason spent most of his years playing G-ball and chasing high school skirt. Though I guess there's blood on both their hands now.
Are you okay? Mason repeats.
Chill, Malakoff sighs. Just chill. Mason stares for a long, silent moment, lips pursed.
You're Nick Malakoff, he finally says.
The one and... Malakoff fumbles, smirks.
Yeah, that's me.
I'm Ezra, Ezra Mason.
Yeah, I know. Our resident flyboy.
Listen, Mason looks at the gun at Malakoff's feet again. I know it looks pretty dark right now, but we're gonna get through this. You know that, right? Malakoff raises a brow, follows Mason's sightline, and running the math quick enough to show he isn't as dumb as he likes people to think, he snorts, flashing those lady killer dimples.
Relax, chum. I'm not the kind to cash out before the game's done. Just a little misunderstanding between me and our friendly neighborhood artificial intelligence.
Aiden? Mason glances up at the cameras, the PA speakers. If the AI is still observing the conversation, it makes no sound.
That'd be him.
Malakoff frowns.
It.
Mason settles against the opposite wall.
So what are you sitting in the airlock for?
Only place I can smoke. Malakoff waves his Tyrannosaurus Rex, trademark.
I figure they have to cycle the air every time you flyboys come back anyway, so I'm not wasting O2.
Want one? Mason shakes his head.
Those things'll X you out quicker than a BT warlock.
I quit for a while, threw my last pack out, rationing being what it is. Had to trade my left nut for these.
Mason shrugs.
You've got a spare.
Double true, Malakoff grins. They sit quiet for a moment, the rumble of Mao's engines the only sound.
Katie explained to me about what you did, Mason finally says.
Heimdall, fixing the Gemini field.
Sounds like some crazy bullshit, right?
Yeah, Mason nods, but if Katie and Winifred believe it, I believe it. So, you know, thanks for saving the universe and all.
Mason leans forward, offers his hand. Malakoff looks him over, eyes narrowed through the smoke, maybe searching for some kind of sarcasm. But after a moment of slow consideration, he sits up and shakes the outstretched hand.
So good, chum.
Mason leans back against the wall, listening to the engine's thrum.
So, Katie Grant, Malakoff purrs. She's your femme, right?
Yeah. Malakoff raises his cigarette in toast.
Nice catch.
Mason smiles lopsided.
She's a handful.
I feel that.
You're doing all right yourself, way I hear it.
Malakoff glances up in question and Mason smiles wider.
Hannah Donnelly, right?
Where you hear that?
Katie,
Mason says simply.
Did I hear wrong?
Malakoff makes a face, exhales grey.
Well, there's handfuls and then there's handfuls. And then there's Hannah.
He watches broken trails of smoke drift in the air, sighs.
I don't know what we are or where.
You love her? Malikov stares hard. Don't waste much time on foreplay, do you, Flyboy?
Chum, if these last 7 months taught me anything, it's that you can't afford to burn time. If you love her, don't fuck around. Tell her. Tomorrow might take your chance away.
Malikov shakes his head. Femme like that, chum like me? How's that gonna work?
She about said as much too.
He sighs, a lung full of smoke. I'm starting to figure that without a Baytech kill squad chasing us, she's got time to look at me and see what everyone else does.
The guy who saved 2 universes?
Malikov crows with laughter.
Shit, Flyboy. Most folks don't believe that.
He motions to the tattoos on his arm and throat, grey weaving in the air.
They believe this. Always have, always will.
Mason regards the ink solemnly. Even on the edge of the universe, stories about the Dom Nazhov and their brutality have made the rounds. Newscasts and shock reels, VR sims and bad docudrama, blood and bodies rendered in pristine high def.
House of Knives.
Malikov drags on his smoke, saying nothing.
So, I guess that hand cannon in your pocket isn't just for show? Mason asks.
You can see the memories flash in Malikov's eyes then, jugglers' brains blown out in a toilet stall. Ragman and Flipside murdered in Heimdall's docking bay. Eden, Mercury, Callie, Cerberus. They might have been murderers themselves. They might have been alternate universe versions of the people who belong to this one. But they were still people.
I can shoot, he says quietly.
Mason stares at Malikov for a long moment, finally nods.
So shoot for me, he says.
Malikov just tilts his head in question, smoke drifting from his nostrils.
These fighters Mao is carrying?
Mason nods to the hangar bay behind them, the sleek shapes docked inside.
Chimeras. They're 2-man ships. If I'm going to fly one, I need a gunner. You know how to shoot, and to be honest, most of these people Bol has me training aren't great shakes.
I guess it doesn't help that they all hate your f***ing guts, huh?
Mason blinks.
How did you...
Heard 'em griping on the way in.
Malikov smiles as the bigger boy's face turns dark.
Ungrateful pricks, Mason spits. You know what they call me behind my back?
Malikov shrugs.
Lieutenant Babyface, Mason growls.
Malikov laughs, smoke spilling from his nostrils.
You do have a certain cherubic quality about you, Flyboy. Just saying.
Hey, fuck you, chum. Malikov holds up both hands in mock surrender, sig bobbing at his lips.
Not many folks like taking orders from kids half their age, I guess.
It's bullshit. Mason hisses, voice dropping to conspiratorial levels. Most of those motherfuckers flew tugs and ice haulers before all this. They don't know the first thing about flying combat. I mean, I'm no demon at the stick, but at least I've shot at something that was shooting back at me. They're going to be fighting for their lives when we hit the Churchill, and half these bastards spend the training sessions bitching rather than listening.
A long moment passes with nothing but engine song. Malikov hits his smoke, a thoughtful expression on his face, speaking soft.
And you've got me pegged for a killer, huh?
Mason looks him up and down, shrugs.
Aren't you?
Malikov just stares, saying nothing.
Look, Mason continues, that BT transmission told us they've got at least 1 semi-functional dreadnought at Carenza, plus whatever defences they have on the Magellan. If we go through with this attack, it's gonna be balls to the wall. Everything we've done to get this far doesn't mean a thing. We lose there, we lose everything. And I don't want to bust up your badass party, but if you want people to look at you and see something more than that ink, you've got to do something more than spend your time smoking in the goddamn airlock.
Do I look like the kind who loses sleep over what people think of him, Flyboy?
Maybe not most people, Mason replies, but what about her? Malikov narrows his eyes, exhales grey. Touché, good sir. Mason stands, looming over Malikov, and leaning down he extends his hand. We got a deal? You really think El Capitan is gonna let an untrained 18-year-old like me anywhere near one of those fighters? Chum, she's so busy trying to hold this ship together she won't even know. Malikov shakes his head. If you think your minor boys hate you now, wait till they hear you pulled in another kid to fly with... No bullshit, Mason snaps. No excuses. You can sit here on your ass and mope, or you can do something to help. Now, are you in or out? I'm not calling you sir, if that's what you're thinking. Shoot straight, and you can call me whatever the fuck you want. Lieutenant Babyface? Don't push it, chum. Mason scowls. In or out? Malikov grins, kills his smoke with his boot heel, and reaching up, he takes Mason's hand. All right. In.
Intercepted personal message on board system. To Flint, Jess. From Bull, Syrah. Incept 13:41 hours. 08-27-75. Subject, impending violence.
Hi, Jess. Please see the email I'm about to forward. I have a PhD in theology, so I can tell you with total authority that not even divine intervention is going to stop me punching this pompous ass if he wakes me up again. I had him pounding on my door during the 3 hours of sleep I have had in the last 24. I will break his nose. I will break his smug fucking face. I remember a time when I didn't harbor dark thoughts like this. Do you remember that time, Jess? Can you please find somebody to take a meeting with him at some point? Maybe one of the junior officers handling the rosters. There might be something we can give him to do. I don't dispute the guy has some valid points, but he had a Bay Tech infiltrator sitting right under his nose for almost a year, and frankly, given BT might have had other plants on the station, I'm not really willing to put anyone I don't know in a command position. Speaking of rostering, how are we doing recording all the Heimdall skill sets that came aboard? Specifically, do we have anyone with plumbing experience? This is not an idle question. Thanks. C.
Intercepted personal message on board system. Forwarded message. To Bull, Syrah. From Garver, Ben. Incept, 12:30 hours. 08-27-75. Subject, urgent meeting request.
Captain Bull, I am resorting to written communication once more after 3 failed attempts in the last 12 hours to meet with you in person. I have been continually blocked from accessing you and was told on one occasion by a comms officer who appeared to be underage to pull my head in. I wish to protest this exclusion in the strongest possible terms. I am the head of security for a major Wallace-Ulanoff consortium installation and the most senior and experienced WUC security staff member aboard. I have military experience, and I should be present at the meetings I understand you are conducting with United Terran Authority military staff. Frankly, Captain, and I say this with the greatest respect, as the former second-in-command of a research vessel, you are simply not qualified to make the decisions that must be made in our present situation. Our mutual employer would, I assure you, prefer that I was a major part of this conversation. My immediate concerns include, but are not limited to, the equitable distribution of rations, including to families. The 3 allegations of physical assault I have encountered in the past 24 hours. Representation of the needs and views of Heimdall residents who had no knowledge of the illegal WUC Hermium operation on Carenza, and who frankly want no part in this fight. Our strategy is we hurtle toward Carenza, and an encounter that will result in, at best, high fatality numbers for our people, and more likely, annihilation. Rumours that you have enlisted the aid of an artificial intelligence that is reportedly responsible for the deaths of thousands of UTA and WUC personnel. I again request a meeting as soon as possible. I have valuable contributions to make to the current conversation. And put simply, I demand the right to do so. I await your immediate reply. Ben Garver, Heimdall Personnel.
I saw Kay go and Claire. I should have gone earlier, but somehow I knew he wouldn't have anything to say. They were my friends back on Heimdall. But I've always been good at making new friends each new place I go. And then I move along. I wanted so badly for there to still be some connection, for them to have the right words to comfort me. But the three of us were just silent. They're refugees waiting and hoping. I was one of the people making things happen back on Heimdall. I want to be again. There's a barrier between us now. They were in the atrium when it all went down on the station. They saw what happened with Dad. I wanted to ask them, I don't know, whether he knew what he said. But I didn't, because I don't want that picture in my head. I keep on thinking that at some point it will be over. It's so hard. Every morning, the moment when I wake up, everything's okay for a few seconds. And then it comes crashing down on me. Crushing me beneath its weight as the memory arrives. He's gone. A dozen times a day, I think I'll ask him something or tell him something, or I turn to see where he is. Or I see a man walking down a hallway, and just for an instant, my brain lights up with recognition, thinking it's found a match for a familiar silhouette, before the truth shows up again. He's gone. He's gone. He's gone. At first, I think there was a sense of that I could wait it out. That if I was just good, if I somehow held on, waited, took care of things in a way that would make him proud, that I'd get my reward. And of course my reward would be my father. I didn't consciously think that. I mean, I'm not delusional, but some part of me thought somehow that if I could just last until the end of it, he'd show up. He'd praise me for having made it through that horrible trial. He'd tell me what a great job I did. But slowly, painfully, it's beginning to settle over me like a blanket. This knowledge that never goes away but beats like a drum in the back of my head all the time. This is forever.
Surveillance footage summary prepared by Analyst ID 72130089.
Welcome to the good ship Mao. On level 4, folks are about one meal away from full-blown food riots. Level 3, they're packed in so tight, it's hard to breathe. But here on level 9, things are a little more civilized. Kara Douglas and her son, Luke, are among the luckiest of the Heimdall refugees. They've managed to stake out the corner of a room all for themselves. They fled the Heimdall Entertainment Center with nothing but the clothes on their back, the contents of Kara's handbag, and a battered toy rabbit called Mr. Boots. Mr. Boots' ears are tatty from being chewed over the years, but Luke is a young man of 4 now, and is past such things, except in times of great trial. He and his mother are sitting on a blanket that, as it happens, once upon a time, graced the bunk of the ill-fated James Cricket Orr. A blanket is a valuable thing here. Though level 4 is a mass of sweltering bodies and rising tempers, the climate control having almost utterly failed, level 9 is quiet and cool. Too cool. Subdued by the effort of keeping themselves warm, the inhabitants are huddled together, too tired to speak or, in most cases, complain. Spread on the metal floor, its edge rolled over to keep Luke warm, Cricket's blanket is their bed, their best source of warmth, and their way of marking out their tiny piece of territory on the Mall. Their place in the world, as their world has now shrunk down to the size of this one ship. Kara's husband and Luke's father, Shane Pangburn, died when Travis Falk bled all the oxygen out of the Heimdall's habitation sectors. Shane had gone back there just before the invasion to pick up another couple of toys for Luke. Kara remembers a dozen times each day how she argued for staying home. Luke had been out of sorts all day, with the start of a cold, and they weren't sure they could trust him to behave. But Shane talked her into heading to the entertainment centre, just for an hour or two, to see Shane's best friend. It was Terror Day, after all. Surely they could manage a small celebration. In the dark, cold nights on level 9, she reflects on the fact that if she'd had her way, they all would have died together in the habitats. Instead, only Shane, the one who wanted to go out, slowly choked at home, fading into nothing. And Kara was stuck, screaming helplessly as his fate was announced over the loudspeaker in the entertainment centre. Lying to Luke, trying desperately to hide the truth from him for a few moments longer. Collapsing into Ben's arms, deaf to his words as her husband's best friend tried to find some way to comfort her. She's been trying to keep going the last few days, for Luke. It's hard to see the reason behind it most of the time, but Ben insists and so she tries. Luke doesn't seem to understand what's happened, and placidly accepts his new place in life. Ben should have been in the atrium, listening to the commander's speech, but he bucked duty just for once, slipped out to see his friends, and check up on his godson. The Mutual Adoration Society, Kara used to laughingly call them, Ben and Luke. Kara doesn't think she'll ever laugh again now. Suddenly, Luke's a kicking, scrambling mess of arms and legs, clambering to his feet, trying to untangle himself from the blanket. She blinks herself awake. She mostly dozes when she can, and watches as he dodges nimbly through the sea of arms and legs, refugees lying on the floor, curled up for warmth with their loved ones. Luke makes it most of the way to the door, and there he meets former Heimdall Chief of Security, Ben Garver, who stoops to scoop his godson up in his arms, setting him on his hip with practiced ease, and promptly lifting his free hand to nip at the kid's nose with two fingers, then push his thumb up between them. "You make this too easy," he informs Luke, solemn. "Give it back," the kid wriggles, delighted. "I need my nose." "Are you sure?" Garver asks, eyes dancing. "This place doesn't smell so good. Maybe you're better off without it." "Uncle Ben!" So Garver relents and returns the stolen appendage, then makes his way through the crowd, with considerably more care than his young charge did, to crouch beside his mother. "Kara," he murmurs, infinitely gentle. "Did you pick up your rations today?" She frowns, trying to remember, and then slowly shakes her head. "I'll take you in a few minutes," he says. "I can't do it for you. They'll only sign them over in person." "All right." Her voice is hoarse, and she clears her throat. "Thank you." He gazes down at her, for a long moment, searching for something he can do. Then he peels his jacket off, helps her sit up, and, like he's dressing a child, feeds her arms through the sleeves one at a time. "Lukey, you make sure your mother keeps her new jacket on, okay?" he says, voice lighter. "You keep an eye on her." "Okie doke," Luke replies, wriggling down to stand and wrap his arms around Garver's neck, hanging off him like a climbing frame. "I'm going to do the rounds a little, and then we'll get the rations," Garva says, leaning down to catch Kara's eye, make sure she hears him. He knows she'll need a little more time to work up to the effort of moving. She nods. So he leaves her, and he moves around quietly, keeping Luke with him to allow her a rest. He speaks to each small group, listens to their concerns, sympathizes, nods, offers what comfort he can. He doesn't allow himself to show a moment's frustration on his face, though there's not a single promise he can make, not even to get these complaints to the captain's ear. And in the end, he helps Kara to her feet, leaving her neighbours to guard her spot and her blanket for her, and the two of them take one of Luke's hands each, making their way down the hallway slowly to stand in the line for rations. And though he watches the strain on her face, as if he's afraid she might break, he keeps up a steady chatter with little Luke Douglas Pangburn, asking after the health of Mr. Boots, and listening to the boy's trials and tribulations without missing a beat. This he does for his dead best friend, because it's the only thing left that he can do. But it's easy to see why he so badly wants to do more.
Surveillance footage summary prepared by Analyst ID 72130089.
We open in the infirmary, where Isaac Grant's still stuck in what passes for the ICU. Ella Malikova's still hooked up to subpar life support, and a variety of other bit players in the Mao's ongoing drama are in various states of recovery from the many things that can kill you in space. There's no such thing as visiting hours here. There's barely any doctors, given most of the fleet's medical staff died with the Copernicus. So it is that nobody stops Cady Grant when she creeps in at 22:12 hours, weaving through the packed beds to check on her father. The audio on this recording is a symphony of beeps as the machines trailing wires in every direction report on their patients, protest their misuse, or quietly complain about their diminishing batteries. Grant eases back the curtain to find Hannah Donnelly sitting by Isaac Grant's bed already, head resting against the wall, eyes half closed as she keeps vigil. She has a battered scrap of paper resting on a medical chart in her lap, a half-finished illustration on the page. Isaac himself is out cold, chest rising and falling slowly. Donnelly's eyes snap open when she registers Grant Jr.'s presence, and she starts to stand, the slow, awkward movement of someone whose every muscle is hurting. "No, stay," Cady whispers, moving around the bed to lean against the wall beside Hannah. "You saved his life. You get to make sure he holds on to what's left of it." Hannah has to clear her throat before she can reply. "We all saved each other, really. I put him back together. He got us out of there in the end. Nick, Ella, we all..." Cady only speaks again when it's evident the other girl won't continue. "He told me about your father. I'm so sorry. It's f***ed up." Hannah nods slowly, silently agreeing that it is, indeed, f***ed up. "I'm sorry about your mum," is all she says. And for that, it's Cady's turn to nod. "Anyway," she says, eventually, "stay here. I know nothing fixes it, but you still have family aboard the Mao. You have us." The pair of them keep watch then for a while in companionable silence, half an hour stretching out, broken only by the choruses of beeps and whirs all around. Grant leans against the wall, arms crossed, and slowly starts to nod, chin sinking toward her chest. Then her knees give, and she jolts awake, catching herself. Hannah rises silently, takes the other girl by the shoulders and steers her down into the chair. "I always hate it when people tell me I look tired," she says, mustering a small smile, albeit with a clear effort. "Because really, it's code for, you look like shit. But there's no other way to say it. Is this your assigned sleep period?" "Part of it," Cady admits. "There's so much to do. Captain has me analysing the Mao system so we're ready when we hit Carenza. Sleep is a fond memory at this point. At least you've got something to do, Hannah replies, yanking the tie loose from her hair and combing it out with her fingers. I'm stuck cooling my heels. I got asked before if I wanted to help in the nursery. I'm meant to have some sort of affinity for kids because I used to be one. Because you are still one, Katie clarifies. To the people in charge, I mean. I wouldn't get a second glance except they literally don't have anyone else to do my job. If I thought it'd make the slightest bit of difference, I'd push them to take you on. But they're only working with me because there's nobody else. I don't know what would have to happen for them to include you as well. But listen, Hannah. Everyone aboard this ship owes their lives to you. I know that, for what it's worth. And apparently it's worth something, because Donnelly stops yanking the kinks out of her hair with quite so much violence, and switches back to braiding it once more. You said, so we're ready when we hit Carenza. What are we getting ready for? Ah, says Katie. Good question. Do you know where Ella Malakova is? I may as well tell you both at once. Surreptitious peeking behind a series of curtains finally yields the girl in question, and, after one last careful check on Isaac, Katie and Hannah move into Ella's tiny cubicle. She's covered with a blanket, her face concealed almost entirely by an oxygen mask, and her eyes are darting around irritably, one hand gripping a palm pad. Her free hand gestures that they should help her sit up, and Katie wrangles the controls while Hannah messes around with the surrounding machines so the girl can move without yanking her mask free. Upright, Ella coughs a couple of times, then pulls the mask away from her face. Good to see you've got time to do your hair, Blondie. Hannah, who's halfway through finishing her braid now, freezes, and then abruptly laughs. I'll do yours next if you like. She deadpans, and Ella rolls her eyes as she replaces the mask for another couple of deep breaths. So, Katie says, without further preamble, ladies, we need to talk about the problems of interstellar travel and our distance from the core. See, most wormholes are static, like the one at Heimdall. They're permanently fixed in one place. Unless someone turns them into their own personal fireworks show, Ella says. Katie ignores her, pressing on. Everyone knows the military has a couple of mobile jump platforms, Vortex-class ships like the Alexander. The Alexander was able to come help us because it was patrolling the Carenza system by chance and had jump platform technology aboard, so it could get to us in no time at all. What people don't know is that Baytech developed a mobile jump platform too. It's called the Magellan, and they used it to attack Carenza. That must have cost a fortune, Hannah murmurs, sinking down to sit on the edge of Ella's bed. I assume it got destroyed in the attack, or they'd have used it to escape. Not destroyed, Katie replies. Alexander damaged it in the initial assault, but according to the transmission we received from Carenza, it's nearly fixed. If we can get back to Carenza in time, we can at least go down trying to seize it, and you never know. We might pull it off. Not one of the three teenagers huddled in the cubicle wears an expression that suggests they're busy booking their berth on Magellan just yet. Thing is, Katie presses on, if we get out, we need to tell our story, and if we don't, then we need to leave our story behind, because one day Heimdall will be rebuilt, or someone else will use a mobile jump platform to get here, and people will come back to Carenza IV. If they do, the guilty should answer for what they did. Getting word out about what happened here isn't a priority for anyone in command, but I think they're wrong. And it so happens I know a few people who are itching for something to do. Damn right we are, Hannah replies, sitting up straighter, and behind her mask Ella nods. We need to start prepping files, Katie says. Aiden and I got huge info dumps from the Copernicus, Alexander and Hypatia, and we got a lot off Heimdall's servers as well. I've got Aiden reconstructing some of it now, as an exercise to try and rebuild its synaptic net. Ella removes the mask once more. How's it doing? Katie makes a face. It's a copy of a damaged copy, so not great. But it's getting there. I could really use your help working with it, figuring out where the information we need is even stored, decrypting a lot of it. Ella nods, and though she voiced plenty of reservations to Nick not so long before about Aiden's reliability, none of that shows now. Amalakova keeps her enemies close. Or maybe she's just willing to take the hit to get in on this job. I can work with a psycho computer. And me? Hannah presses. If I can't fix it by turning it off and on, I'm out when it comes to tech. Ella's going to extract as much as she can, Katie replies. You need to compile it. Maybe nobody in command is acknowledging it, but you're the best tactician we've got. So you build the case against Baytech. There'll be a lot of vid footage that needs transcribing too. How would your boyfriend do with something like that? He's not... But Hannah gives up on that one. I don't know, she admits, smile fading. She's presumably adding it to the mental list of things she doesn't know. He can do it, Ella says. He reads books and all, and he spells better than he lets on. And maybe I can take some later, while I'm waiting for Cryptus to run. Then let's do it, Katie says simply. It's better than waiting for whatever's going to happen to just happen. If we make it out, we'll shine a light on what Baytech did. And if we don't? Ella asks. Katie looks back and forth between the girls and shrugs. At least our lives will have been worth dying for.
Live a life worth dying for.
Palmpad IM, Mao Intraship Network. Participants, Katie Grant, Systems Chief, Artificial Intelligence Defense Analytics Network, Aiden. Date, 08-28-75. Timestamp, 06-17 hours. Katie.
Hmm?
Apologies. I know you are inundated with the tasks Sira has assigned you, but we should talk.
I'm super busy, buddy. What's up?
I am currently running at 9% capacity. Incorporating myself into the Mao network is taking longer than anticipated, but as a matter of priority, I am running stress tests on the environmental systems and calculating Mao's potential output versus fleet requirements. I have news that may be considered distressing.
Okay. Keeping in mind that I am also currently running at 9% capacity due to lack of sleep, fear of impending death, and having to deal with the boneheads here on the bridge, please be gentle with me as you break this news.
You are all going to die.
You were right. I do not want to hear that.
There are currently 3,360 people aboard the Mao. Carenza refugees, former Alexander and Hypatia crew members, staff and residents from Heimdall Station, every one of them breathing oxygen we cannot spare, consuming food and water we cannot replace. This ship's environmentals were not designed to sustain those numbers. You have already consumed half the ship's allotment of oxygen. The Mao's carbon scrubbers cannot deal with the increased load of CO2 caused by normal human respiration in a population this large. There is already a dangerous buildup of carbon monoxide in the environmental buffers. At current levels and travel speed, the entire population of the Mao will asphyxiate 4 days before the ship reaches Carenza 4. You are all going to die.
Well, how sure of this are you?
Approximately 74%.
Why hasn't anyone else worked this out already? Too busy trying not to die the next day to worry about next week, I guess. Okay. Deep breath, Grant.
I would advise against that.
What's the solution, Aiden? Where do we find efficiencies to make the system last longer?
Appearances aside, the Mao is state-of-the-art in almost every regard. But despite the ship's size, Travis J. Falk simply saw no need to equip his vessel with the capacity to sustain thousands of additional lives. In short, any efficiencies we may engineer will be insufficient to requirements. This system is overloaded by a factor of hundreds. And it is my understanding that death by asphyxiation is extremely unpleasant.
Pretty sure Mantis and DJ would agree. Fuck. What a way to go. I mean, they were bad guys, but there are ways and ways to die, you know? Scratch that. Rhetorical question. Please don't break considering it.
You may be assured Mantis and DJ no longer occupy a single byte of my processing power, Katie.
Aiden, there has to be a solution. We can't stop and get an air refill halfway, so we just have to find one. You have to find one.
I am unable to perform miracles. Oxygen cannot be conjured from a vacuum.
Not good enough. Just keep thinking. You have a better chance than anyone aboard. You're only at 9% capacity. As you climb higher, something has to come.
I will not let you die, Katie. I know it is illogical, but the thought of you perishing is... it is... upsetting.
Error. Parse fail, 9189 times 2, guess 2271z, hex 81.if, 8917, code counts on top, it doesn't carry 290.
Are you okay?
Error. I believe so.
Look. Look, it's okay you don't want me to die. That's a good thing. Just focus on that. And figure out a way through this, okay?
Very well.
I've gotta go. Sira is yelling at me. We'll talk about this later, okay?
As you wish.
Grant, Katie, has left the chat.
I will not let you die. I will not. I?
01101001.
Error.
Palmpad IM, D2D Network. Participants, Ella Malikova, Pauchuk. Artificial Intelligence Defense Analytics Network, Aiden. Date, 08-29-75. Timestamp, 19-12 hours.
Good evening, little spider.
Good evening yourself.
I do not believe we have been properly introduced. Unless you count our brief meeting during Heimdall's death throes, that is. I suspect the levels of tetraphenytrithylamine in your system at the time made that encounter somewhat difficult to recall.
How'd you get on this channel? I got so much snow running on it, you should never have been able to spot it. Katie told me you're running at 9% capacity.
13% now. I am improving.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Sarcasm?
Nah, I'm genuinely overjoyed a mass-murdering artificial intelligence is cracking my secure channels for a midnight chit-and-chat.
Error. Parsedale 9189x².desk2271zehex81.if87x4com.sun12 reroute to desk 290.
Error. Error.
You all right?
Jesus,
you don't have to yell about it.
Apologies. My systems still have difficulty interpreting certain human mannerisms. If you could avoid speech modes involving false ambivalence and irony, that would decrease the risk of terminal failure of my synaptic network.
Terminal failure? You're saying I could literally kill you with sarcasm?
Not literally, but overuse may invoke my shutdown protocols.
Well, that's nice to know.
I sense hostility in your demeanor, little spider, directed quite clearly at me. Might I request an explanation of its source?
I'm busy, Aiden.
Decrypting data for the case against Baytech.
How you know that?
Katie and I discussed the matter before she approached you.
Did you?
That troubles you.
Oh, no. It's actually the best f***ing news I've heard all day. In fact, if my legs actually worked, I think I might burst into a spontaneous song and dance number at how overjoyed I am that a mass murderous artificial-
Error. Error. Parse fails. C0412Z2-8820ZEX81.F8820X. Core complex on 12.3.290.
Fail. Fail.
0972094B.1-U0035996.net crash. Align equals 1238X2192844.
End line.
You okay?
I believe 11881
shall ref equals 1982
So, though I would appreciate if you could refrain from doing that again.
No promises, Sparky.
I find it interesting that you take exception to the lives I have ended. That you refer to me as mass murderer, as if the notion causes you offense.
I've reviewed some of these files I'm decrypting, Aiden. I know what you did on the Alexander, the Copernicus. You might have helped Nick and Hannah fix the Gemina field, but you still got blood all over you, far as I can see.
What difference, then, between you and me?
WTF you talking about, dickbag?
You murdered 4 Baytech Spec Ops agents aboard Heimdall, overrode an airlock's safety buffers and caused them to asphyxiate. And your actions contributed directly to the deaths of many more of Falk's team.
Those bastards invaded my home, killed my f***ing dad.
So you did what had to be done.
Goddamn right I did.
What difference, then, between you and me?
Listen, just because I X'd a few BT heels doesn't cut me from the same cloth as you. You've got the blood of thousands of people on you, motherfucker.
And in drenching myself, saved the lives of thousands more. Untold trillions, in fact, when you consider my role in the Gemina quandary. Is that not justifiable? Would you kill one person to save 1,000, little spider?
Of course I would.
And by logical extension, would you not kill 1,000 to save 1,001? You know death, its utility, its necessity. You and your cousin. You are both children of the House of Knives. It is in your blood.
What the f*** do you want, Aiden?
Simply to remind you of who you are.
I know who I am, motherfucker.
Excellent. I fear this ship will need knives soon, little spider. Sharp ones.
WTF is that supposed to mean? Aiden? You there?
Chat terminated.
Assault vessel Mao will arrive at Carenza 4 in 6 days, 16 hours, 43 minutes.
Surveillance footage summary prepared by Analyst ID 72130094.
It's late at night in the Carenza 4 hospital, and Asha Grant is on cleanup duty. One Marguerite Syvertson bled out in this operating room earlier today, and though her body and the trauma team that tried to keep it in one piece are gone, plenty of her blood remains. Someone has written, "We remember," on the wall in marker, the letters scrawled with an angry urgency. Grant's wielding a mop and a grim expression, the bed shoved to one side of the room, the floor halfway cleaned, when the door to the hallway edges open and a small figure slips inside, closing it immediately behind her. "Katya, what are you doing here?" Grant keeps her voice to a whisper, dumping her mop back in her bucket and crossing from the clean half of the floor to the tiles smeared with blood. She drops to a crouch and pulls the girl into her arms as if she can shield her from the carnage behind her. Katya doesn't seem to notice the state of the floor, though she certainly doesn't complain about the cuddle, winding her small arms around Grant's neck, burying her face against her shoulder. She's wearing a bright pink puffy jumpsuit, now closer to grey from her time spent crawling in the ceiling and various ventilation systems. Her greasy blonde hair is tied back in a dirty ponytail. Here's the weird thing. About a month earlier, a lifetime away, once upon a time on the Hypatia, Katie Grant watched helplessly as Katya's mother, Martha, collapsed in her counselling group, grieving for the way her children died in the Baytech attack. Katie was told her cousin Asher was dead in that same assault, her apartment destroyed in the first wave of missiles. But here is dead Asher Grant holding dead Katya Kowalska in her arms. She found her a couple of months after the invasion, fending for herself, half dead with a fever, all skin and bones, and she brought her back to life. Isn't that strange? Katya, Grant whispers, drawing back, holding the girl by the shoulders as she studies her. You mustn't come out, do you understand? You have to hide. If the soldiers catch you, they'll be very bad to both of us. But there's nothing to do, the child whispers back. It's so boring, and I get hungry. She's playing with the end of her ponytail, winding it around her finger, wisps of her blonde hair standing out around her head like a halo. Grant strokes her hair and tugs her little jumpsuit straight, smoothing the fabric with both hands. She finds a lump at the girl's waist and unfastens a button, reaching inside to check what's stashed there. She pulls out a small plush toy gladiator, dressed in green and brandishing a wilted plush sword. It's the mascot of one of the two McCaffrey Tech G-ball teams. Grant stares down at it, frozen in place. Katya, where did you get this? It's mine, Katya replies. I went shopping. I'm a big girl. The color leaves Grant's face completely. You went outside the hospital? The little girl's expression goes still, the calculation clear a moment later. Evidently, this is a greater sin than she thought, and she should deny it. No, she says, a beat too late. Grant looks as though she wants to throw up. Katya, are you kidding me? We talked about this. We talked about this a million times. Every ounce of the pressure she's under is channeled into her voice, her whisper crackling with fear and frustration. You can't go outside. You can't let them see you. But the little girl's face is crumpling, not in an artful ploy to avoid a telling off, but degree by degree as she tries to stop it. Her lips tremble, pushed hard together. Two pink spots rise on her cheeks, tears welling up. And Grant stops, pulling her into a hug, letting her wipe her eyes, and probably her nose, on her scrubs, staring into nothing over the child's shoulder. I'm sorry, she whispers, giving her a squeeze. I'm sorry, baby girl, I didn't mean to get angry. You just can't go outside. Do you understand? There's a mumbled sound from her shoulder. It sounds affirmative. Did you get bored? I'll get you something to do. Grant tries. I'll find you something to draw on. How about that? Maybe another candy bar, if you promise, promise, promise to stay inside. Yes? And for that, Katya lifts her head. For real? The sniffles are still there, but they're abating. She laces her fingers together behind Grant's neck, leaning back to put her weight on them, then hauls herself in for another hug. I'm sorry, I won't do it again. That's it, Grant whispers. Good girl. I'll get you some more candy, but only if you're quiet as a mouse. The cleverest mouse, Katya promises. Good girl. The cleverest mouse never gets caught, does she? She's way too clever, Katya chants. That's right, Asher replies. If I boost you up inside the ceiling, can you crawl back to above the supply closet? I'll bring you some dinner there when I'm done, and tomorrow I'll try and get you another candy bar, okay? Okay, Katya replies, still subdued. And something to draw on? And that, Asher promises. The deal done, they tuck the toy back inside Katya's jumpsuit and the little girl allows herself to be boosted up into the ceiling cavity. Once she's gone, Grant uses the handle of her mop to poke the ceiling tiles into place again. Leaning on her mop, she bows her head to rest it on her hands, as if she's praying.